40. They couldn't figure out how to shut off the music.
"Check behind the bookcase," Sig said.
"You think I didn't?" John Casper Williams asked, staring up at the speaker in the ceiling, then searching the walls for a dial or off switch. The music was classical, something with a piano. It was one of the two constants when you came to see Chaplain Pete. He always played music, and he always had candy on his desk. Today was fruit-flavored Tootsie Rolls, though only the yellows and pinks were left.
"Maybe it's playing straight from God," Casper said, his Tennessee accent saying the word God like it was two syllables.
The youngest of seven siblings, Casper had a plump nose, hair the color of smoke, and just enough of a devilish twinkle in his green eyes to make him the go-to guy when it came to throwing all five of his brother's bachelor parties. Those same talents had been put to use 2 years back for Zig's going-away dinner, where Casper ordered a massive sheet cake with light blue frosting that read, "Goodbye, Quitter." At Dover, the Navy required a 3-year rotation. Many request early transfers, the heartbreak becoming too much. Casper got a special exemption that allowed him to serve for nearly a decade, the third longest-serving employee since Zig left. Heart or no heart? Heart to the 10th power.
"Casp, it's fine. Forget the music," Zig said, glancing out the window, making sure no one was coming.
All clear, though he couldn't shake the feeling a storm was on its way.
"You expecting someone?" Casper asked.
Zig shook it off like it was nothing. He was wrong about that. Zig took a seat across from the chaplain's desk and clicked at the laptop Casper had brought. On screen was a Dover autopsy report. Name of deceased, Mint Archibald. Cause of death, gunshot wound of the head and neck. Manner of death, homicide. Zig had read the report yesterday. When you're the mortician, they give you a copy, along with a few ID pics stapled in the corner, so you'll have a guide as you rebuild the victim's face. Flicking his finger, Zig scrolled past the report, down to what he was really after. The file labeled photos.
"You take these?" Zig asked.
"Does Dolly Parton sleep on her back?"
Zig shot him a look. "Do not mess with Dolly Parton. That woman is a saint."
"Am I from Tennessee? You should be thanking my state just for birthing her."
Zig knew he meant it. After 3 years of running the Navy's newspaper on the USS George H.W. Bush, Casper had wanted one thing: to get off the ship. The first job opening that came up was Dover photographer, where he took photos when top Pentagon brass came to tour the main base so they could pose with the fighter jets. Soon after, he got transferred to the mortuary, taking photos of the flag-covered coffins as they were carried off the cargo planes. But what really made him rise through the ranks was his ability, no matter how intimate the setting. Even when the President of the United States came years ago to pay his respects after the passing of astronaut John Glenn, to disappear into the background. Like a ghost, someone said, earning Casper his nickname.
"Casp, you sure this is everything?" Zig asked with a finger swipe to the left, scrolling through a cascade of photos.
Every moment since Mint's body arrived at Dover. The first shots were always the same. A closed transfer case with Mint's ID tags, then the canvas body bag with handles on the side when its steel zipper was first opened. Priority number one was making sure you had the right fallen soldier. From there, as the fallen soldier's body was placed on a conveyor belt and x-rayed to make sure there was no unexploded ordnance or other booby traps hidden inside, Casper took photos of all of Mint's personal effects. Wedding ring, cell phone, crumpled receipts in his pockets, plus every item in his wallet, from his driver's license to gas cards, gym membership, school pictures of his kids that were clearly a few years old, and an old laminated fortune from a fortune cookie that Mint kept. "Your dearest wish will come true." Casper even took photos in the autopsy suite, where there were 10-foot ladders, like someone was painting the ceiling. Casper had installed the ladders years ago, so he could climb high enough for a shot of the entire body. As the autopsy progressed, he'd add shots of each wound at every point of impact, from bullet wounds in the skin to punctured livers or hearts, as well as every scar, tattoo, and beauty mark. Details that a family needs before they'll accept that their son or daughter is dead. In the photo Zig was looking at, Mint was on one of the autopsy tables, naked, his clothes cut away, his bare arms and legs bent awkwardly in that way only a corpse bends. He had 2 small tattoos, both on his right shoulder, baby handprints with cursive script underneath, one labeled Huck, the other Violet. His kids. Zig swallowed hard, taking a quick glance outside, like he was checking to see if Chaplain Pete was coming. But right now, he wasn't thinking about Chaplain Pete. "Another couple inches and the bullet would have blown out his whole face," Casper said. Zig nodded, turning back to the screen. Yesterday at the funeral, Colonel Mint was dressed in full dress uniform, looking serene, the repair work all done. In this picture, taken just before the autopsy began, his buzzed blonde hair was a mess of blood and sweat, his mouth sagging open. There was a tidy black hole in Mint's left cheek, then a bigger hole where the bullet exited, diagonally down the right side of his neck, bits of burnt skin shredded like black crepe paper. According to the medical examiner, the bullet missed his skull, hitting only soft tissue. What actually killed him was when it pierced the carotid artery in his neck. "Is it me? Or does his coloring look off?" Zig asked, flipping to the next pic, one of just the top half of the body, enlarging Mint's face. "Gray's gray. That's his skin," Casper replied, standing over Zig's shoulder, reaching for the chaplain's candy dish and unwrapping a pink Tootsie Roll. "Not his pigmentation. His..." Zig pulled in even closer to Mint's right cheek, the one without the bullet hole. "Here, does it look like something got smudged or wiped away?" Casper leaned down, squinting at the screen. "Maybe," he said, eyeing the slightly darker sheen just below Mint's eye. When Dover photos are taken, the photographers are supposed to clean things up so the focus can be just on the wound. "I honestly forget. Swipe back to the beginning," Casper said. "Sometimes, when you pull someone out of the body bag, blood smudges across their face." With a hard swipe, Zig scrolled back to the very first pics. But even there, Mint's right cheek looked a bit darker. "Ziggy, you searching for something in particular?" "Just a hunch." Casper made a face, rolling his tongue inside his cheek to pick out the Tootsie Roll from his back teeth. "How about the truth this time? Tell me what you're really doing here." "Casp, I told you, no, don't say this is just some random hunch. I know that look, Ziggy. I see the way you keep eyeing the window, like someone's hot on your tail even though you're in a secure military facility. You came here for a reason. Tell me what's got you so anxious." Zig again glanced out the front window, that photo of Mint's belongings still fresh in his head. Gas cards, a gym membership, a few receipts. The crap we leave behind. Your dearest wish will come true. On screen, Zig swiped to the end of the file, to the autopsy, where there was a blue sheet with a round hole in it that offered a close-up of Mint's face. The sheet was there to block out everything in the background, so that in each photograph you could focus just on the fallen soldier, not the nearby rolling carts with the scalpels, rib cutter, or bone chisel. In the photo, one of Mint's eyes was open, staring straight up, his pupil cloudy and dark purple, like a scab. "Here. It's here," Zig said, flipping back to the full body shot of Mint's naked body flat on the table. Zig shifted the photo on screen, pulling in tight on Mint's right hand, where there were 3 red marks. the same ones Zig noticed during the funeral when he readjusted Mint's hands.
"Scratch marks?" Casper asked. "What about them?"
Whoever shot Mint, they did it from the driver's side of the car. Mint was in the back seat. In front of him was the valet who was behind the wheel. Both of them took bullets on the left side of their heads, through the driver's side glass.
So who made these marks on Mint's right hand?
Casper shook his head.
Maybe those scratches were from a different night.
Look at the photos. That's not old blood. Casper leaned in closer, flipping forward a few photos. As photographer, he took close-ups of every wound. Sure enough, he had a close-up of the scratches. He squinted at the screen. The wounds were fresh.
What if the valet scratched him? You know, when Mint grabbed him from behind.
Another good theory. Except I called the local MEs who did the valet's autopsy. There was no skin tissue under his fingernails.
Okay, Ziggy, I get it. You're doing the full Quincy.
But for all you know, Mint scratched himself, Casper explained. Remember that pilot who popped out his own eye when his Chinook got shot and crashed? You've seen what happens on impact.
Casp, that was a helicopter crash from 1,000 feet. This is a man sitting in his own back seat, supposedly by himself.
Casper's eyes narrowed.
Back up. Time out. You think Mint was with someone else in the back seat?
That's a hell of a theory, Zig said, a thin grin spreading across his face. One I bet we can check. They both sat there a moment, classical piano still playing from above.
One last file, Casper. That's all I need.
41. Abingdon Medical Center, Abingdon, Maryland. Most people hate hospitals. Wags loved them. They reminded her of giving birth and those very first days when her son Vincent was a little pink marshmallow lying there on the nursing pillow as she'd gently tickle his toes to make sure he stayed awake during feedings. So much had gone wrong in Wags's life. What happened with her mom? Plus her marriage, which even then was already sinking. But when that baby arrived healthy, with no complications, for Wags it was the only thing that had ever gone exactly right. God, it had been a lifetime since she felt like that. "Welcome to Abingdon. Who are you here to see?" asked the security guard, a 70-year-old man with a cauliflower nose, skeptical hazel eyes, and 1950s horn-rimmed glasses that were so old they'd come back in style. His name tag read, "Stan the Man." "It ain't a hard question, ma'am," he added in a heavy Philly accent, already annoyed. "You here to see someone? Only two choices, doctor or patient." "I'm actually looking for..." Wags pulled out Nola's military ID photo. "Her name's Nola Brown. She look familiar?"
"She looks miserable."
"That's her smile." Stan the Man laughed, warming up. On the corner of his desk was one of those day-by-day dog breed calendars. "You sound like a cop," he told Wags.
"Let me guess," she replied. "You used to be one. 30 years in South Philly. In the bag," Stan the Man added proudly, meaning he didn't ride a desk. He was in uniform on patrol, working the radio. "Dealing with actual people."
Wags smiled. 30 years on patrol meant no promotion, which probably meant he was a wild one back in his youth. Sure enough, among the liver spots that dotted the old man's knuckles were a fair share of old scars. "Here's some cheap advice. Don't leave. The real world sucks," Stan the Man said. "Anyways, tell me who you're on the job for, because you smell like a fed."
"You still got it, Stan the Man," Wags said, flashing her FBI badge.
"Now that's a nice photo.
You got a good smile."
"I tell people that. No one believes me."
"Ooh, a charmer too. That's my weakness. You got a boyfriend?"
Wags hesitated for half a second. "I'm joking," he teased. "Tell me about Nola Brown. What did she do?" "Unclear. Apparently she was here 3 weeks ago. I'm trying to figure who she was seeing. If she signed in, I assume that's in your system. Is this the 21st century? I used to have to knock on 10 doors to get all we got in here. Let's take a look, he said, pecking slowly at his keyboard. Eventually, he hit enter, squinting at the screen. Yeah, I got her right here. 42. Ziggy, if I get fired for this, you're taking over my house payments, my car payments, my Netflix, too, and Disney Plus. You're not getting fired. You're doing your job, Zig said, sitting there at the chaplain's desk, the background classical music suddenly familiar, something that had been in an American Express ad a few years back. He was locked on the laptop screen, no longer glancing out the window. If he had been, he might have spotted the car that was just pulling into the parking lot. Almost there, Zig told Casper, adding check marks to various digital boxes, like he was placing an online restaurant order and picking toppings. At the top of the screen were the words Hounsfield Units, the measurements used to describe the radio density of a CT scan. On screen, a grayscale image appeared showing a full 3D rendering of Colonel Mint's body. In the Dover mortuary, CT scans were still a new thing, instituted back in 2006 when the military decided that every fallen service member from Iraq and Afghanistan required one. It wasn't out of kindness. The 3D record was a way to learn how bullets and shrapnel tore through a body. After seeing wound after wound in the same spot on soldiers' necks, the Army realized that their body armor needed to be redesigned to better cover their necklines. It had been a constant for centuries. With every death, governments learn how to make better war. These scans are going to put me out of business one day, aren't they? Casper asked, squinting at the laptop. On screen, the CT showed Mint's organs, lungs, kidneys, heart, in muted gray tones, with precise details, right down to the maze-like squiggles on his brain. Are those spots? Blood, Zig said, pointing to what looked like gray leopard spots in Mint's neck, trailing down toward his lungs. When the bullet pierced his throat, he started inhaling, and those final breaths filled his lungs with blood. Casper nodded while his hands twisted the wrapper from the Tootsie Roll into a tight braid. Of course, what jumped out most was the actual wound. Bright white spots, tiny supernovas, running from Mint's cheek diagonally across his neck, leaving a spray of scattered gray gravel in their wake. The gray spots are bone and tissue, but these bright white dots are metal. Fragments of the bullet, Zig explained, tapping the tiny supernovas on screen. Back in his Dover days, Zig used these CT scan images when he was rebuilding a fallen service member's face, so he'd know where the roughest patches of shrapnel would be. Is this supposed to tell us something about the scratches on his hand? Casper asked. Depends who did the scratching, Zig explained, scrolling up to Colonel Mint's skull. According to the Dover medical examiner, the valet was in the front seat and Colonel Mint was in the back. But with the magic of technology, Zig clicked on a drop-down menu labeled Imaging and deselected the boxes marked Blood, Soft Tissue, Muscle. With each click, the CT scan blinked. The leopard spots showing Mint's blood disappeared. His lungs and the rest of his organs disappeared. Then his musculature disappeared, eventually leaving only one box unchecked. The sole thing Zig wanted to see. Bone. On screen, Mint's chest became a rib cage, his face now a pale gray Halloween skull, though his empty eye sockets and nose were faded because the CT allowed you to see a full 3D image that ran all the way through to the back of the head. As before, where the bullet first hit, there were bits of stray bone floating inside Mint's skull, fragments of Mint's mandible that got embedded in the soft tissue of his throat. Since the bright white bullet fragments were no longer visible, what jumped out now was, Ziggy? I see it, he said, eyeing a brand new set of speckled white dots like gravel that were embedded in the side of Mint's skull. Not on the left side where the bullet hit, on the right side, just above his ear. Are those?
Is that bullet shrapnel?
Not bullet, Zig said, pointing to the checked box. It's bone shrapnel.
Zig hit another button, zooming in close, the tiny white fragments looking like a dozen broken pencil points, all embedded deep in Mint's skull. We couldn't see it in your regular photos. It was hidden under his hair.
Ziggy, I still don't... Mint got shot on the left side of his face. So how did bits of his own bone... How'd they get on the right side of his face, much less that high in his hair?
Because of this right here.
Zig scrolled in closer, the pencil points now looking like snowy mountaintops.
That's not his bone. Casper nodded as it started making sense. He'd photographed it plenty of times before. With bombs and bullet wounds, fragments of one victim get lodged in the other.
Okay. So if those bones aren't Mint's, you're saying they're the valet's?
Not at that angle. The valet was in the front seat. This hit Mint squarely on the side, some of it behind his ear. Which means...
Ziggy, you're giving me these dramatic pauses like I'm supposed to be reading your mind. Just say it.
Here.
Zig pointed to his own skull. If I'm Mint, and the valet's in the front seat, when the valet gets shot, bone shrapnel will most likely hit Mint here, he said, pointing to his own forehead and his temple area. But for fragments to hit me here, he said, pointing diagonally above his ear on his right side, at this angle.
You think Mint wasn't the only one in the back seat?
That someone else was next to him?
You got a better explanation?
Casper gave the twisted Tootsie Roll wrapper one last twirl as it finally tore from the tension. He was still staring at the CT scan of Mint's grayscale skeleton.
Is that who you think scratched those marks into Mint's hand? The shooter put a bullet in Mint, then a bullet into the valet, then they crossed around to the passenger side and... Scratch!
Casper paused.
Ziggy, if you're right, I'm right. I'm not arguing. I'm just saying...
He pointed his torn Tootsie Roll wrapper toward the screen.
For those bone fragments to be jumping out like that, we'll...
How'd our own Dover medical examiners miss it?
Who said they missed it? Zig challenged.
Casper sat up. The classical music was still playing, though both of them barely heard it.
Time out. You think someone here...
All I'm saying is, 3 days ago, Mint's body should have gone to Pennsylvania's local medical examiner. He's a civilian. Instead, for reasons we still can't explain, it came here. To make that happen. They said Mint used to work at Dover, but we now know that's a lie. Then they brought me in as the mortician, telling me they needed my rebuilding skills, which was their second lie, since near as I can tell. They brought me in because of my link to Nola. The point is, whatever really happened with Mint's death, far too many people are putting in far too much work to make sure no one finds out what the hell is really going on.
Casper nodded, standing from his seat and tossing the Tootsie Roll wrapper in the trash. On a short filing cabinet in the corner were neat stacks of dozens of Bibles, each stack a different denomination for families of the fallen.
Maybe you should... I don't know. Go to the top. Talk to Colonel Whatley, he said, referring to his boss, the head of Dover.
Whatley's the one who put me on the case.
Whatley was? You're sure about that?
Casper, whoever did this helped alter Mint's medical examiner report and his death certificate. On top of that, the way they sped him through Dover? You know how cases move. It can take up to 2 weeks.
But Mint was in the ground within 3 days, which also keeps law enforcement and everyone else from getting a good look at the body.
You really think they could pull all that off if they didn't have permission from every higher-up in here?
Casper stared at the Bibles, well aware of the answer.
Ziggy, maybe this isn't the best fight for you to be picking right now.
So I'm supposed to just turn away and ignore it all?
No. You're supposed to stay out of trouble, which I guarantee won't happen if you keep digging into military secrets. For all you know, Mint's a secret squirrel, and they're just trying to keep his mission quiet.
You really believe that?
Casper stayed silent. He'd been through enough secret squirrel cases to know their vibe.
Fine, I hear you. This one reeks. but if you're not careful. You know how many cameras you passed coming in here? You need an actual plan.
I have a plan, Zig insisted, rapping his knuckles against the screen. I find out who these bones belong to, and once I have that...
The office door swung open, revealing a petite woman. She had chestnut-colored hair and military posture. Zig knew her, though not from here.
Sorry. Oh, geez. I'm interrupting, aren't I? She asked. I'm Colonel Mintz.
I'm his wife, Tessa explained, holding up a manila envelope.
I'm looking for the chaplain. They said he was... Am I even in the right office?
Zig froze, but not for long. Come on in, he said, closing the laptop and motioning her inside. This is absolutely the right place. Please, take a seat. Welcome to the chaplain's office.
43.
Wait, I know you, Rint's wife blurted. Zig started to speak, but never got the words out.
From the funeral, Tessa insisted, stepping toward him, shutting the door behind herself. You're the guy. You worked on Archie.
On his body. The mortician. Zig, he said, extending a handshake, which she gripped like a lifeline.
You fixed his smile. I appreciate that.
She searched for more small talk, but that was all she had in her. Her eyes were puffy, her bottom lip showing signs of an emerging cold sore. At the funeral, she wore her public face, stoic and composed. But there's only so long you can hold that in place. The facade was fraying.
Mrs. Mint, Casper interrupted, if there's anything you need.
Archie used to say you should never trust anyone who doesn't have family photos up in their office, she said, forcing a laugh and looking around at the pale yellow walls, which, in addition to a Navy poster, held a simple crucifix, as well as a framed Navy flag that looked like it was from Vietnam. But I guess in here, you don't want to.
She didn't finish the thought. She didn't have to. When you bury a family member and come to the chaplain's office, the last thing you want to see is someone else's smiling family.
I got this letter, Tessa added, holding up her manila envelope.
Zig knew what it was. When someone in the military dies, their family gets a packet notifying them of every available procedure and benefit, from how many honor guard will fold the flag at the funeral to how to get the autopsy report, which must be requested. On average, 85% to 90% ask for the autopsy, which came in the exact type of manila envelope Tessa was now holding. Inside was a cover letter that read, in bold letters, "It is strongly recommended that you read this in the presence of people that can provide you with emotional support." Families can also request the photographs that were taken of their loved one's body. Only 10% ask for those. Tessa was one of them.
I'm gonna regret this, aren't I?
She asked, pulling the report and a stack of about 80 photos from the envelope, the military still printing them out like it was the pre-digital age.
Mrs. Mint, Casper interrupted. Now he was the one staring out the window, though Zig didn't know it. If you wait, the pastor would be back in it.
My neighbor offered to come sit with me, she said, not hearing a word.
But the thought of doing this in my house.
With the kids?
Her voice trailed off, her eyes locked on the first photo, showing Mint's metal transfer case with his ID tags on top.
So, is this...
They took these right when he arrived, huh? She asked, flipping to the next photo, of her husband's gray face peeking through the open body bag.
Ma'am, you don't have to do this now, Zig said.
But she did. In the past 24 hours, Tessa had seen the body, hosted the funeral, and held her shaking kids as the casket was lowered into the ground. But like so many military families, it's not until she examined the raw photos, with their mundane, dreamlike images of his lifeless head and bloodied wounds, that it finally hit her, that her husband was never coming home. For 2 minutes, Tessa sat there silently, flipping through the photos like an old record collection, her perfect posture just starting to crack. Grief at a funeral is communal. Here, it felt like just her and Archie.
She was gutted, undone.
You know,
I met him in the army, she said, flipping to a new photo. At Fort Drum. I thought I wanted to be a combat medic. Archie was so pushy. He signed up for a new shift, to drive a bus on one of the routes I took every day. That kind of guy, Tessa said, as Zig stepped closer, putting a hand on her shoulder. Did you know they tell everyone not to touch us? She asked. Zig, not sure whether he should keep his hand there or pull away. It's part of the training. For the team that comes to tell you that your spouse is dead. No hugging. No touching. Just deliver the news and leave. Casper shot a look at Zig. They shouldn't be here. This wasn't their job. But Zig wasn't leaving her. When we got married, Archie stayed in the army. He wanted to deploy, but I left. Figured dental school was safer. She laughed, flipping to a new photo, a close-up of Mint in profile, the small black bullet hole in his cheek. As a military spouse, you don't want to imagine the worst, but you do. Especially when a friend told me to count how many people they send. If one person shows up at your door, your loved one is wounded. If two show up, he's dead. Mrs. Mint, I know it sounds bananas, but for all those years he was deployed, that's how I thought it had happened. I'd come home and see two soldiers in my driveway, and I'd just know. But instead, she flipped to the next photo, the close-up of the exit wound in Mint's neck. My phone lit up with a text. That's it. I'm sitting at Violet's nightly baseball game, yelling, "Good job!" for every kid who strikes out. And this text pops up from Jerry, my neighbor. You need to get home. By the time I did, there were sirens up and down the block, Tessa said, flipping faster through the pics, barely looking at them until she stopped at one of the last ones. It wasn't of Mint. It was a photo of his open wallet. Personal effects, Zig explained, though it was clear that Tessa knew what she was looking at. She flipped to the next photo, also of Mint's wallet, though here it was empty. All the money, every dollar, 3 singles, 2 5s, and 4 20s, spread out on a wooden table, close enough that you could read the serial numbers. When a fallen soldier returned home, these bills became totems, final gifts passed down from parent to child. As a result, Dover was meticulous in making sure that each and every dollar, even the stray coins found in a victim's pocket, were the exact same ones they arrived with. God, look at him here. He's a child, Tessa said, flipping to the next photo, which showed Mint's driver's license, military ID, and the rest of his credit cards. In both ID photos, Mint had the same look, chin up, chest out, the full at-attention stare, his ice-blue eyes fixated on something distant. Did I tell you he didn't know how to smile? Tessa asked, flipping to a photo with a AAA card, his Costco membership, and a random assortment of... Tessa made a noise, an actual gasp, at the one she should have seen coming. Half a dozen school photos of their kids. They were all out of date, scuffed by bits of wallet crud and laid out one next to the other like crooked teeth. In the first one, their son Huck was wearing a wide smile, pre-puberty, showing off braces. His blonde hair was a sweaty mess, his face red and damp, since that was the year the photo was taken right after gym class. Next to it was a photo from their daughter's Little League, a fake baseball card, with Violet in batting stance, holding a pink metal bat like a murderer. You have kids? Tessa asked, without looking up. Zig's usual answer was no. When you bury a child, the last thing you want is to answer the standard follow-ups. How old? Are you close? What do they do now? Better to say no and keep things easy. But for reasons he wouldn't understand until he was lying in bed later that night, Zig said, Yeah, a daughter. Casper shot another look at Zig. Do not engage. How old? Tessa asked. 12. She turned around. Same as Violet, Tessa said, her voice straining, her eyes pleading. Zig knew that tone, and that look. He'd seen the same look on his ex-wife, and on himself. It always came after the funeral, when mourners sit in solitude and grasp at those thoughts that are too hard to think about, but can no longer be avoided. When you recognize your new reality and it dawns on you how much you don't want to live in it.
They're going to be okay, Zig told her, motioning to the photos of her kids. She will be, Tessa said, tapping her daughter's baseball card. Violet's afraid of nothing, like her dad. But Huck, he's who I'm worried about. My idealist, she said, flipping to the next photo. I fear we've cracked his faith in the... She cut herself off, spotting something in the next photograph. In Zig's pocket, his phone started vibrating. Caller ID said Roddy. Zig hit dismiss. Is this right? Tessa asked, Zig craning his neck and now seeing what she was looking at. A photo of Mint's dog tags, cell phone, and wedding ring. Zig's phone vibrated again. A text appeared, also from Roddy. Pick up. Emergency. I'm serious. Who took these? Tessa asked.
The photos? Those were... That was me, ma'am, Casper called out from the corner. Is everything...
Zig's phone buzzed again. This time he picked up, stepping away from Tessa. Make it quick, he whispered.
I found him, Roddy blurted.
Found who?
Mrs. Mint, are you okay? Casper asked.
I'm just... Tessa pulled the photo close to her, pointing to the iPhone in the picture.
His phone.
Did you not get it back? Casper asked. They should have given his phone to you, at the funeral.
They did. In the bag.
They gave me his ring, his wallet,
and his phone.
His iPhone, she said.
But here.
Look. There are two phones here. She pointed to the bottom corner of the photo. Mint's iPhone, but also an outdated flip phone. Zig turned, no longer listening to Roddy.
Why'd my husband have a second phone? Tessa asked.
It was a good question, but not nearly as important as the one already twirling through Zig's brain. Where was that phone right now? 44. Nola started at the townhouse's back door. To her surprise, it was ajar. She shook her head. Bad sign. Sure enough, as she used her elbow to open the door, she found the kitchen floor caked in blood. From her pocket, she pulled out two blue plastic foot covers, tugged them over her shoes, and stepped inside. The neighborhood was on the edge of the hood, but nice enough that cops would come running. Last thing she needed was her footprints being part of whatever had happened here. On her left, toward the sink, was a young Dominican man, 25 years old, Zion Lopez. Nola let out a sharp breath through her nose, more annoyed than anything else. She squatted down for a better look. Zion's throat was slit, a clean, deep slice. Single incision, no big swipes or slashes, which meant no struggle or fight. More important, no hesitation wounds. Whoever did it, they did it fast, precise, definitely a pro, someone who knew their way around a body, like a soldier, or doctor, even a cop. Was this Roddy's work? Too soon to tell. Next to Zion's body was a shattered vodka bottle, its stem still intact, caught off guard, or maybe using it as a weapon. At the foot of the body was a Walmart bag with a box for an Oscar the Grouch mask. A final message. This was the guy who'd pulled the trigger on Colonel Mint. She could feel it, though it wasn't bringing her the resolution she'd thought. Instead, it just added more questions, more anger, and another dead body. It reminded her of one of her first missions as artist in residence, painting Navy SEALs who were tracking a Taliban leader to the small Afghan village of Sabre. To keep Nola safe, they put her in back with the command and control element so she'd be the farthest from the action. Yet as they approached the town, they were ambushed from behind by 30 attackers from an entirely different village. The old back became the new front. Nola fought hard that day. They all did. But what stuck with her was something the SEAL commander said when the medics came.
In every mission, the one thing to always worry about is what you don't know. The unknown unknown, especially when it's coming for those you care about. At that, her brain flipped to Mint's wife, Tessa, and the kids, Huck and Violet, wondering what their night was like. And then she was thinking of Mint himself, and that very first evening in Grandma's pantry, when Mint came back from a short dinner break and surprised everyone by bringing chicken sandwiches for the whole team, including Nola. He must want something, she instinctively thought back then as she pulled the tomatoes and lettuce off the sandwich. She was wrong, though even then she didn't realize how much. 2 days later, Mint again brought sandwiches, giving Nola one with no tomato or lettuce, handing it to her as if she'd been on the team for years. Such a stupid story, Nola realized, though she'd now thought about it 3 times in the past 24 hours. With her foot, Nola nudged Zion's head to the side to get a better look at his wound. As she knew, slit throats usually started high on one side of the neck and finished lower. Higher on the left side meant the killer was right-handed, slicing left to right. Higher on the right side meant left-handed. Oddly, Zion was sliced dead center. Nola made a mental note. Piano wire, fishing string, even a thin metal saw. Once she'd heard of Iraqis who used glass-laced kite string to take off the head of a kidnapped journalist. Leaning down, she went through Zion's pockets, wallet, keys, but no phone. She made a note of that, too. But what was niggling at Nola more than anything else was the unknown unknown. Zion killed Mint, tracking him here, finding Zion. That should have been the end. Instead, it led to another beginning, a new front. Someone else had gotten here first and murdered Zion, a new player, and, by the looks of it, a far more dangerous one. Glancing over her shoulder into the sun-drenched backyard, Nola noticed 2 different paths through the tomato garden, multiple footprints, like a team. Nola pulled out her pad and pencils. For the next few minutes, she stood there by the sink, sketching the body, the kitchen, then the rest of the house, trying to see what she missed. A quick sweep of the bedrooms revealed a stash of synthetic marijuana, Adderall, and Molly, all hidden in a fireproof toolbox in Zion's closet, plus nearly $4,000 in cash literally tucked under his mattress. Drug dealer. That's what it looked like, or was supposed to look like. Small time, trying to work his way up. So was that what this was about? Some petty deal that went wrong? Nola stared at her notepad, at her drawing of Zion's stash of pot and Molly. It didn't seem right. Colonel Mint was pure polish. He didn't drink coffee, much less buy drugs from some 20-something scrub. More important, whoever killed Zion, they left the stash behind, plus the cash. When they came here, their mission was clear, take down Zion. So was this punishment for Zion killing Mint, or just a way to keep him quiet? Still rolling through the permutations, Nola made her way back to the living room, where she sketched the pale green shoji screen, the bamboo bench, and all the other overpriced accessories that looked like they were from West Elm's Japanese collection. Every other room in the townhouse was bland, practically bare. Upstairs, Zion's bed didn't even have a headboard, much less all this Japanese decor. Zion was entertaining down here, doing business, trying to make an impression, Nola thought as her pencil skittered across the page, giving shape to the black lacquered bookcase with upturned shelves that resembled the flying eaves of an Asian rooftop. More Chinese than Japanese, Nola thought. Item by item, she filled in the shelves of the bookcase, drawing quick renditions of a narrow Japanese bud vase, a paper lantern, some old books, a jade tea set, and on the page, Nola sketched a bright yellow doll, a stuffed animal. It was a minion, actually, from Despicable Me, with one big eye and overalls that Nola looked up from the page, at the bookshelf, then back toward the living area. Every single item in the room, the couch, the lamp, the shoji screen, the tea set, every knick-knack on the bookcase. It was all Japanese, except this yellow minion. Cocking an eyebrow, Nola headed for the shelf. The minion's overalls had a little black dot at the center, like a belly button. But as she got closer, the way it shone, nanny cam. Of course Zion had a nanny cam. He was doing business here. Even drug dealers need an insurance policy in case something goes sideways. 2 minutes later, Nola was sitting at Zion's laptop, a USB cord running from the computer to the port underneath the minion's foot. Waiting for the camera to connect with the desktop, she also noticed, on screen, an icon for Black House. Zion apparently had an account, or at the very least, was watching someone else's. Right there, Nola's brain flashed back to the scene, when she'd first logged into Black House and saw Mint's digital avatar, or whoever was using his avatar. There was another soldier there, a Hispanic one, with close-set eyes. That was Zion. No doubt about it, Nola realized, looking back at the body in the kitchen. Yet as she replayed it in her head, it begged the question. Who was Zion meeting with in Black House? Someone who was a friend? Or was that who killed him? The question would have to wait. On the desktop, there was a ping as the icon for the nanny cam appeared. Wasting no time, Nola hit play. On the screen, the last few minutes of Zion's life bloomed into view. 45. I knew it, Tessa barked, storming out of the chaplain's office. Those lying motherfu- Mrs. Mint, please, Zig pleaded, chasing after her. This area, you can't, I know you hear me. You think I wouldn't find it, she shouted, waving the manila envelope, her tight ponytail pumping behind her as she plowed down the carpeted first-floor hallway that contained Dover's senior staff offices. The Carpet Canyon, everyone called it, a not-so-subtle jab. Every other floor in the mortuary was concrete or industrial tile, surfaces built to withstand blood and body parts. Ma'am, I need you to stop, a male secretary called out, rising from his seat. He wasn't nearly fast enough. With a sharp right, Tessa stormed into the one office that every staffer knew was off-limits. Inside, a black man with a side part shaved into his afro looked up from his desk. He had a wide face, like a billboard. Late 40s, retro gold wire-framed glasses and wearing a drab olive Air Force flight suit. Zig knew who he was, even without the name tag on his chest. Colonel O.J. Watley, Dover's wing commander, the second black man to ever hold the top job. Zig had never met him before, but come on, his outfit alone. Most heads of Dover wear formal uniforms, military dress, shirt and tie. Their flying days are mostly done. So for Watley to still be sporting a flight suit like he's about to take off in Top Gun mode, heart or no heart? Outlook not good. OJ, Tessa said in a tone that would leave a bruise. Tessie, he replied, trying to make nice. Zig was still in the hallway, determined to stay out of sight. Casper, he whispered to his friend. But as Zig turned, the photographer was long gone. Soon enough, Zig would realize he should have taken off too. Mr. Zigarowski, a voice called out, OJ's secretary. Arturo? Zig asked, recognizing the kid with the squatty fingers who used to work in Dover's laundry, ironing fresh sheets for the fallen. What are you doing here? Promotion, you? Because, it kind of looks like you're eavesdropping. I'm actually with a client. Recent widow, Zig said, pointing toward Tessa, who was still unleashing on Colonel Watley. Arturo nodded. He'd seen it before. You know, one night, I was delivering laundry at like 2 a.m. Everyone was gone. But you were here, Mr. Zigarowski, working on this young female naval aviator whose F-14 went down. 2 a.m. And that wasn't the only night I saw you here, he added, heading up the hallway and waving goodbye. I need coffee. Enjoy your eavesdropping, Mr. Zigarowski. Tessie, please. Take a seat, OJ said, still standing behind his desk as he motioned her to a chair. With his pointer finger, He pushed the bridge of his gold-rimmed glasses up on his nose, Zig wondering if it was OJ's way of buying a moment. With all you've been through,
I want his phone, Oren.
If you just sit down,
I want his phone. I saw the photos, she roared, waving the manila folder so hard, a few of the pictures rocketed to the floor.
She caught her breath, locking eyes with OJ. Whatever was going on, these two knew each other. Two phones, OJ. My husband clearly had an extra one. I know you have it. It's my job to have it. We're still investigating.
That's another lie.
It's like your helmets, she said, pointing to his credenza, the I love me section of his office, which held half a dozen flight helmets. You know, Archie once told me that most of those aren't even yours. They're your dad's. But you thought keeping them on display would help you make full bird. And look at that. Here you are, Colonel. Tessie, I know you're in pain. Spare me your pathetic TED talk. He was with her, wasn't he? That's who the phone was for. For the first time, OJ didn't respond. You think I'm an idiot? I know him 25 years, Tessa said, her voice finally slowing down. You have any idea how much Rashida cost us in marriage therapy? Rashida? Zig knew that name, from the back of Nola's canvas. One of her first military paintings. From Grandma's pantry. Archie meant Rashida Robinson, Elijah King. It reminded Zig of... Wait, he just saw... There, right in front of him on the assistant's desk, was an old-school logbook for incoming and outgoing calls. Every wing commander's assistant used one to make sure there was a written record for when a fallen soldier's family member insisted, I called 10 times and no one called me back. At the top of the logbook were two entries, outgoing calls, one last night and one this morning to Elijah King, the third name on the list. Comments? Left message. Still no reply. I'm getting warmer now, aren't I, Oren? Tessa said, still focused on Rashida. Maybe it's better if I call her myself, she added, pulling out an imaginary phone. Hey, Rashida! Remember all those years ago when you were fucking my... She's dead, OJ said. What? Rashida's dead. We found her body 2 nights ago. Out by the airport, burned to a crisp. Cops tagged it as suicide, but... Let's just say we're looking into it. Some spouses would have burst into tears. Military wives? They were built different. Sure enough... Tessa stood at the center of the office, planted like a telephone pole. She stared down at the folder of photos, her brain still working through the details. Archie told me. Her voice wavered, but not for long. He said he was going to the steakhouse, that it was a work thing, but... She shook her head. Is that who he was with? Were he and Rashida still... She met him at the steakhouse. We know that for sure, OJ said. What we don't know is, when the shots were... We think she might have been in the back seat with Archie when he got shot. She was. Zig knew she was. He'd seen it on the CT scan, from the bone shrapnel that he'd found in the side of Mint's face. When Zig first saw it, he didn't know who the bones belonged to. But to hear this, that Rashida and Mint were meeting at the restaurant, and that their history was more than just work-related, Zig glanced around the empty hallway, putting together his own pieces. Could OJ and the Dover medical examiners have missed it on the CT scan? Maybe at first, especially since it now seemed clear that someone had pulled Rashida's body from the back seat. But from what OJ just said, he knew that Mint wasn't alone when he got shot. On top of that, he knew that Mint and Rashida were together that night. And if that was the case... How could you not tell me? Tessa asked OJ. Tell you what? That we're as concerned and lost as you are? This is from that night. It goes back to the pantry, doesn't it? That's a theory. It's more than a damn theory. It's why you took this case.
It is why I took the case. But Tessie, I swear to you, it wasn't until we actually brought him in that we found the second phone, which, by the way, forensics is still digging through. Call me old-fashioned, but I prefer not to dredge up my friend's worst mistakes until I know what the hell actually happened, which I'm glad I did, considering we're now chasing a second body.
So you think?
Tessa swallowed hard, trying to steady her breath.
The fact they're both dead.
You don't think they were still...
Tessie,
if you're asking me why they were meeting in a steak restaurant, I can't possibly give you a definitive answer. Years ago, with Rashida, Archie made a mistake that I know he forever regretted. And I realize how it looks. But now, for them to both turn up dead, plus all the extra work that someone put in to make sure none of this seems connected. I know it's emotional, but objectively speaking, at least to me. OJ again pushed his glasses up on his nose. This seems less like something intimate, and more like something work-related. It was a perfect explanation, presented with perfect logic, but as Zig stood there in the hallway, it still didn't explain one key detail. If everything the colonel just said was true, who the hell moved Rashida's body? In truth, Zig had seen it before, when two of our spies were killed on a top-secret mission to protect their identities, the government would sometimes move one of the bodies so no one would know they were working together. Could that be the case here? That it was done before OJ and the Dover folks got there? It was as good an explanation as any, but to pull it off took manpower. Paperwork had to be filed, supervisors had to approve, and most important, the right undercover team had to swoop in fast enough to...
Mother trucker!
Zig missed it at first, but there it was, on OJ's credenza. The flight helmets. These days, the Air Force had stopped letting pilots decorate their helmets like Maverick himself, but since the colonel was older, his helmets had printed call signs above the front visor. There were a few from the Cold War era that clearly belonged to his dad. The newer ones had the word Pop Top along the top visor. Those were OJ's, along with various wing and squadron emblems along the sides. The very last one also had a familiar unit logo, a hand grabbing two bright yellow lightning bolts. Semper Vigilis. Zig felt the blood rush from his face. Of course. Archie Mint, Rashida Robinson, Elijah King, and now, Colonel O.J. Whatley. All of them in the same unit. A unit that clearly had a deeply personal stake in whatever happened all those years ago at Grandma's pantry.
So at the stake place, you don't think they were...
Tessa let out a huff, her eyes welling with tears. Good tears. As a wave of relief rolled over her.
Tessie, he loved you. You were his...
Come here, OJ insisted, crossing around his desk, arms extended for a hug. Tessa stepped toward him, arms flat at her sides, her head sagging back, crumpling desperately, thankfully into his embrace. As a mortician, Zig had spent decades seeing people at their best and worst. Yet there's always that moment when a mourner reaches their physical limits and finally realizes that no matter how strong they're pretending to be, death always sees you for who you really are and always gets what it's after. Fight all you want. At some point, there's nothing to do but surrender. This doesn't mean I'm forgetting about his phone, Tessa whispered. The colonel laughed, tightening his embrace. You'll get it, I swear. I'll bring it tonight. Maybe for dinner? You still have to eat, right? What about Elijah? Have you heard from him? She asked. We're trying. No response. Let's get you home, the colonel added, ushering her to the door. Both of them now headed toward Zig. Zig tried to run, but there wasn't time. Sliding into a nearby rolling chair, he kept his back to the colonel, quickly skating toward the assistant's desk, which had the same Captain America mouse pad used by nearly half of today's young troops. Anything else you need? OJ began,
their voices fading up the hallway. For 2 seconds, Zig sat there frozen. In the distance, the door clicked. All clear. They were gone. Wasting no time, Zig took off at full speed, rounding the corner as...
Come on now, Mr. Zigarowski, Colonel Whatley said, pushing his glasses up on his face. Did you really think I wouldn't see you sitting there?
46. Abingdon Medical Center, Abingdon, Maryland. Mrs. Silvestri. Mrs. Silvestri, you awake? No response. Mrs. Silvestri, can you hear me? Wags asked, standing in the threshold of room 404. According to hospital records, it was the same room Nola came to visit 3 weeks ago, to see this particular patient, Mrs. Thelma Silvestri. Inside, the lights were off, though on the far right, two big windows framed the morning sun as it bathed the room in a golden glow. From what Wags could tell, Mrs. Silvestri was asleep, her head turned away toward the sun, as various machines beeped and whirred in their usual chorus.
Ma'am, are you...
Wags added, faking a cough loud enough to wake even the deepest sleeper. Mrs. Silvestri still didn't respond.
She's not going to answer, a male voice called out.
Wags quickly turned, spotting a barrel-chested African-American orderly with hangdog eyes and an outrageously contagious smile. He was pushing a rolling cart filled with old paperback books. Name tag read, Raleigh. What's wrong with her? Wags asked.
You a cop?
How does everyone know that?
Stan the man. Walkie-talkie, he explained, pointing to his belt. For some reason, he likes you. He doesn't like most people.
Wags forced a laugh, hoping to keep him talking.
You were saying about Mrs. Silvestri?
Listen, with HIPAA,
I got 3 kids. I need this job, so can't get into details, but look around.
You see what floor you're on? Raleigh asked, pointing to a sign by the nurse's station. Neurology.
Apparently, as Mrs. Silvestri was driving down the highway, some kid on an overpass thought it'd be funny to drop a ski pole on a passing car. It hit her.
Raleigh made a noise like a dart hitting cork as he pointed to the center of his own forehead.
Traumatic brain injury, right through her frontal lobe. Can you imagine?
Wags could. For the better part of a decade, she'd seen firsthand what homemade bombs do to victims around the world. Taking another step into the room, she got a good look at Mrs. Silvestri's face for the first time. Her mouth was open in an upside-down crescent moon, frozen mid-scream. She was probably only 40, but was so gaunt. Her hair ragged, her skin practically translucent. She looked twice that. There were tubes in her nose, throat, and stomach. Ventilator, tracheotomy, feeding tube.
So she doesn't speak? Wags asked.
Not until a few weeks ago.
Didn't you? I figured that's why you were here.
It was all over the news, the orderly said. Reading Wags's confused look, he added, Mrs. Silvestri's accident happened nearly 2 years ago. She couldn't speak. Minimal brain activity. Complete vegetative state. Then, 3 weeks ago, out of nowhere, she wakes up, asking for 2 things. Chocolate pudding and her husband, who died a decade ago.
I saw this story.
Everyone did. The local news went wild, demanding interviews. It was a total madhouse. It didn't last long, though. 4 days later, her eyes rolled back into her head, and she returns to this. He motioned toward the patient.
Isn't that right, Mrs. Silvestri?
No response.
Let me ask you, Wags said, those few days she was awake. Was one of those June 19th?
Raleigh squinted upward at the room's popcorn ceiling.
That sounds right. What about this woman? Wags asked, pulling out Nola's photo. Ever seen her before?
That's a terrible picture.
Girl can't smile. But yeah, I seen her.
Describe seen her. The orderly went silent.
Please don't make me use the badge, Wags pleaded. She gave me $50, okay? Wags cocked an eyebrow, confused. Why would Nola give you $50? I told you, the news crews, they all wanted access. One of the nurses took $200 to get a photo of Mrs. Silvestri finally eating her pudding. And it wasn't even the chocolate one. So Nola paid you? To paint. Draw? I don't know. I figured she was one of those artists who paints pictures in courtrooms. She asked for 10 minutes. I gave her 10 minutes. Was that when Mrs. Silvestri went back into... She pointed toward the bed. What? No! She went back into her coma after. It had to be after. He thought about it a moment. Right? Wags pulled out her phone, quickly doing the math. According to hospital records, Nola had been here on June 19th, 2 days after Mrs. Silvestri woke up from her coma. From the online news report, she went back into her coma the following day on the 20th. Do we know why she lost consciousness? Wags asked. Wait. You think your artist friend? Wags didn't know what to think. It could have been Nola, or someone who visited after Nola. Hell, it could have been any of the 10,000 things that usually go wrong when someone has a traumatic brain injury. No way to know for sure. Still staring at her phone, Wags swiped back to the map with the other locations that Nola made special trips to over the past few weeks. 3 places in total. 1 down. 2 to go. 47.
Does being back feel like a time machine, Mr. Zigarowski? Someone told me this was your old office.
It wasn't, Zig shot back. Mine was down the hall, closer to embalming. And the actual fallen, where the real work gets done. Colonel Whatley stayed, all smiles, sitting at his immaculate desk, which was made of glass. Through the top, Zig could see OJ's legs, his chair, and his right hand, which held the staple remover that he was clicking like a tiny shark. Chomp, chomp, chomp. Like his predecessor, OJ dedicated the left wall of his office to freestanding flags, American flag, Air Force flag, POW MIA flag, and of course flags for Dover's 436th and 512th airlift wings, each on its own flag stand, lined up like a firing squad. The only thing that had changed in the office was the ceiling. Zig couldn't see it until he got inside. Above the desk, OJ had removed 2 of the industrial ceiling tiles and replaced them with translucent ones that held a big, full-color photo of what looked like a Hawaiian paradise, complete with crystal blue water, palm trees, and an empty lounge chair with a coconut cocktail on one armrest and a purple orchid lei draped over the back. Zig had seen something similar in his dentist's office. The hygienist said the ocean view helped people find calm. A simple trick, so you don't focus on the coming assault.
You know, I've been to your funeral home, the colonel said, his grin perfectly in place. Must have been 4, 5 years back. I don't think you were working there yet. A friend of my grandfather, 92 years old, full life. Though all I really remember is everyone saying it used to be a Dairy Queen. I mean, a funeral home in an ice cream shop. What's crazier? A politician in a flight suit? OJ laughed out loud, like that was the plan all along. Chomp, chomp, chomp. Mr. Zigarowski, despite what you think, I'm not the enemy.
I know you hired me, Zig blurted, for Mint's funeral. You're the one who pulled me into this.
Our office only hires the best morticians.
You could have called any local mortician. You brought me in because you knew my connection to her. You thought it would help you keep Nola off balance.
And if I did?
You could have just asked me.
That's good advice, Mr. Zigarowski.
I think I'll take you up on that, the colonel said matter-of-factly, his hands now resting on top of his desk, still holding the staple remover.
Zig shifted in his chair, glancing up at the Hawaii photo glowing in the ceiling. I don't understand. Do you really think I just want to talk about your old job, Mr. Zigarowski? What I really need is a favor.
48. Keenley, Pennsylvania. 15 years ago.
This was Nola when she was 13. It was 4 days before Christmas, which, for Nola, didn't mean much. Since he first took her in, Royal had told her that good Catholics knew Christmas wasn't about decorating or gift-giving, which just promoted excess. Yet, for some reason, in this small house that they'd moved to, where there was a plastic bucket on top of the refrigerator to catch the 2 leaks whenever it rained, Royal was suddenly pointing out cobwebs in the ceiling corners and having Nola vacuum with Carpet Fresh, or rather with some knockoff called Carpet Renew. Most important, he was buying stuff. Real stuff. For years, Royal hadn't purchased stockings, a tree, or even presents, except for that year he got her a cinnamon candle because he said she was starting to smell. First thing this morning, though, Royal went full Christmas spirit. Stockings, lights, an actual gingerbread house, even a big fake silver tinsel tree that most people bought for kitsch value, but Royal bought because he thought it looked expensive. Plus, he didn't want crap loads of pine needles all over his carpet-renewed carpet. "Who's coming?" Nola asked. Had to be a client. It was. Elias Avery Jr., who ran a chain of motels from Pennsylvania to New Jersey, was a potential buyer for the 200-odd lot fax machines that Royal bought at auction last week. Most important, he loved Christmas nearly as much as Jesus himself. "Make it look good, girl," Royal warned on his way out. That was 2 hours ago. So when the house phone rang twice, then went silent, Nola knew the signal. Royal and Mr. Avery were on their way home from their fancy seafood dinner. Make sure the house is perfect. Scrambling and rearranging the last few ornaments, she brought as much as she could to the front, thinking it didn't look perfect, but definitely better than before. It reminded her of her last and only Christmas with her old family, the LaPointes, and how all the kids were encouraged to decorate, but as they did, Mrs. LaPointe would circle the tree behind them, subtly redoing everyone's work, moving tinsel and ornaments higher and lower, none of the other kids noticing that they had nearly nothing to do with the breathtaking final product. Nola tried to remember what she got that Christmas, but all she remembered was that Roddy kept asking for one of those magic tricks where you pretend to cut off your finger. Hearing a car in the driveway, Nola scooped up the packaging for the ornaments, darted for the kitchen, and stuffed it all under the sink, so Royal could return everything when this was done. Ding dong. "Coming," she started to yell, then caught herself, remembering how Royal told her to say it. "On my way." As she sprinted back to the door, she reached under her skirt and pulled down her blouse to straighten it, a trick she'd seen that bitch Leslie Cushman do in the girls' bathroom. With a twist, she opened the door and smiled. "Miss Konnikova?" "Nola, how are you, dearie?" asked a heavy-set woman with brown hair in a tidy ponytail. Lydia Konnikova, the troop mom from Nola's old Girl Scout troop who used to run carpool and drive everyone from school, which really was the only reason Royal signed her up for scouts in the first place. Nola hadn't seen her in at least a year. "Is it too late?" "It's too late," Ms. Konnikova said, Nola remembering that she always answered her own questions. "I know it's been a while, but when you moved away, no one knew how to find you. Joyce Gluck said she heard you were living on a houseboat, which is actually a dream of mine." "Ms. Konnikova, all I'm saying is, I'm not usually such a snoop, but last week, I saw you and your stepdad pulling out of the gas station by Robbie's Grill, and, well, I know technically you're now zoned for the troop in this county, but, well, we miss you, so..." "Ta-da!" she announced, holding up a dry-cleaning bag with a lime-green scout uniform inside. "It's great, isn't it? So great," Ms. Konnikova added, stepping inside even though Nola didn't invite her. "We want you back. Say yes. Oh, and if it doesn't fit, I can hem." "Ms. Konnikova,
I'm not supposed to let anyone... Huh, Ms. Konnikova said, her wide hips shifting as she scanned the dingy living room with its cracked black leather sofa and outdated glass coffee table that held a neat stack of Sports Illustrateds. There were no pictures on the walls, no curtains on the windows, but all Ms. Konnikova was staring at was the sparkling silver Christmas tree that stood in a corner like a stripper pole. Years later, Nola would have the right word to describe the look on her former scout mom's face. She thought it was confusion or disappointment, but it was pity. "What are you doing?" a sharp male voice called from outside. Nola turned, her stomach folding in on itself. "You hear me?" Royal demanded. As he burst through the doorway, Nola searched for the familiar rage in his eyes. But for once, there wasn't any. "Nola, you okay?" Royal asked, sounding concerned. Nola cocked her head. It was a tone she rarely heard. "Looks like a party," another voice called out behind Royal, a balding man with a cul-de-sac of silver hair. Royal's client, Elias Avery Jr. That's why Royal was on good behavior. In barely 2 minutes, the entire interaction was finished. Ms. Konnikova thanked everyone for letting her interrupt. "Please, Nola, think about it. We'd love to have you back." Then headed home. Royal and Elias were on their way to the den, excited for the fake-labeled drink that Royal would be serving from the bar. And Nola? She was right where they left her, standing by the silver Christmas tree, still clutching the hanger with the brand new Girl Scout uniform. No question. There'd be a price to pay tomorrow for letting a stranger in the house. She saw it as Royal turned the corner, glancing over his shoulder with his devil smile, that look she knew so well. "We're not done, girl." Right now, though, the far more brutal wound was the other look, that one she wouldn't be able to shake for weeks, the sadness and sorrow on Ms. Konnikova's face when she got a look at Nola's life. 49. Today.
"It wasn't me. For the 95th time,"
Zion screamed on screen, stumbling through the living room. Nola leaned toward the screen of Zion's laptop. The video from the Minion nanny cam was crisp and in color. 4K, she realized. Ultra high def. As Zion raced toward the kitchen, a woman with pale skin and a blue leather coat strolled behind him. She moved gracefully, almost joyfully, like she was relishing it. No question, a pro. Her head was turned, so Nola couldn't get a good look. But her hair, a redhead. "Zion, if you run..." He ran, scrambling forward out of the camera's eye, disappearing into the kitchen. From there, the rest of the video was an empty living room with far too many Japanese accessories. Once Zion and the woman reached the kitchen, the audio was muddy. Nola couldn't hear a word. Someone yelling, then silence. A few minutes later, a towering boulder of a man, also with red hair, though he looked more Irish, lumbered into the frame. Entering the living room, he headed straight for the coffee table, his meaty paw grabbing the one item that Nola hadn't noticed at first. A phone. Now it made sense. These redheads, two of them, they killed Zion. They took his phone, and clearly, they had a head start. Not for long.